Hello and welcome to Dining with Death. This episode is on our playlist, Dining with the Disappeared, where we discuss individuals who have vanished, we talk about the circumstances of their disappearance, and we discuss the location where they vanished from, which often has an element of food tied to it. On this playlist, we usually have a little bit of hope because in most cases, we're not sure that the people involved have passed. So stay tuned to the end because we always give out some information on how you might be able to help bring some closure to these cases. I'm Stacey Lee. Let's begin. On November 24th, 1971, the day before Thanksgiving, a man sits in a Boeing 727 plane sipping a bourbon and soda. He hands a note to flight attendant Florence Schaffner, who is seated in the jump seat across from him. She drops the note into her purse, unread, assuming it is the man's phone number. The man then leans forward and says to her, "Miss, you'd better look at that note. I have a bomb." The story of D.B. Cooper has become part of true crime and aviation legend. It is one of the most famous and mysterious disappearance cases in the annals of American crime. On Thanksgiving Eve, 1971, a middle-aged man dressed in a black suit and white shirt, carrying nothing but a small attaché case, used cash at the Northwest Airlines counter at Portland International Airport to purchase a one-way ticket on Flight 305 for a 30-minute flight from Portland to Seattle. He boarded the 727 aircraft and took seat 18C in the rear of the passenger cabin. The flight was about 30% full and departed Portland on schedule at 2:50 p.m. After he was served his drink, the man handed the note to the flight attendant and turned this average and everyday flight into one that would live in infamy for all time. The note was printed in neat, all capital letters with a felt-tip pen. We don't have a photo of that note because the man took it back after he delivered it. Once the flight attendant read it, the man, who said his name was Dan Cooper, told the flight attendant to come and sit by him. When she did, she asked to see the bomb. Cooper opened his attaché case and showed her a device with eight red cylinders, four on top and four on the bottom, attached to wires coated in red insulation and a large cylindrical battery. He closed the case and then said he wanted $200,000 in negotiable American currency, four parachutes, two primary and two reserve, and a fuel truck standing by in Seattle ready to refuel the aircraft they were in when it landed. The flight attendant was visibly shaken and the man put his hand on her shoulder and told her to calm down. She walked to the cockpit, which in those days was open to the rest of the plane, and informed the pilots that the man wearing the dark sunglasses had a bomb and they were being hijacked. The pilot, William A. Scott, then contacted Seattle-Tacoma Airport via traffic control and informed local and federal authorities of what was happening. The other 35 passengers on the plane were told that their arrival in Seattle was being delayed because of a, quote, minor mechanical difficulty. Flying isn't my favorite thing to do, and I don't love this story because it tells you that they never quite tell you the truth when there's something going on, right? Donald Nyrup, the president of Northwest Airlines, which was then going by Northwest Orient, authorized payments of the ransom and ordered all employees to cooperate fully with the hijackers' demands. The plane then circled Puget Sound for about 2 hours while Seattle police and FBI gathered the ransom money, the parachutes, and the fuel truck along with emergency personnel. The man, who was later misidentified as D.B. Cooper, which is the moniker that stuck, seemed to be familiar with the area. As the plane continued on, he pointed down and said things like, "That looks like Tacoma over there." The flight attendants report he was calm and polite. He ordered a second bourbon and soda, which he even paid for, and then asked the flight crew if they would like him to request meals for them to be brought on board when the plane landed in Seattle. Although that was kind of a nice gesture, I'm sure their hearts kind of sunk because at that point they were like, "Oh, we're not getting off the plane in Seattle." On the ground, the FBI assembled the ransom money from several area Seattle banks, $10,020 bills and made microfilm photographs of each bill. They offered the man military-issue parachutes, but Cooper refused them and said he wanted civilian parachutes with manually operated ripcords. Seattle police then went and obtained them from a local skydiving school. At 5:24 p.m., police informed Cooper that his demands had been met and the aircraft landed at Seattle-Tacoma Airport. Cooper instructed pilot Scott to taxi the jet to an isolated area of the runway. He demanded the crew close all window shades in the cabin so snipers could not see into the plane. Northwest Airlines Seattle operations manager Al Lee approached the aircraft and delivered a cash-filled case and parachutes to one of the flight attendants via the back stairs. Once the delivery was complete, Cooper ordered all the passengers and several of the crew to leave the plane. As the plane was refueled, Cooper told the cockpit crew that they were to set a southeast course towards Mexico City at minimum airspeed and the lowest altitude possible. He wanted the landing gear to remain deployed, the wing flaps lowered to 15 degrees, and the cabin to remain unpressurized. He was preparing to jump. The pilots informed Cooper that the plane would not make it where he wanted to go without an additional stop, so it was decided that the plane would stop in Reno, Nevada to refuel. Cooper then demanded that the stairs be left down, and the pilots opposed this, saying that was very unwise. Cooper said that if they weren't left down, he would just release them after takeoff. An FAA official requested a meeting with Cooper at the stop, but Cooper refused. About 2 hours after landing in Seattle, the plane took off again, carrying only the pilot, co-pilot, flight engineer Harold Anderson, flight attendant Mucklow, and the hijacker. A Lockheed T-33 trainer shadowed the Boeing 727 until it ran out of fuel and was forced to land. Once the plane was back in the air, Cooper tied what the flight attendant believed to be the bag of money around his waist. About 30 minutes after takeoff, around 8 o'clock p.m., a warning light went off in the cockpit, indicating that the rear stairs had in fact been activated. The co-pilot picked up the intercom and asked the hijacker if he wanted assistance with the stairs. Cooper refused. The crew then felt a sudden change in air pressure, which indicated that the back door was open. They had been instructed by the hijacker to keep their eyes forward and did not see him when he jumped from the plane wearing a parachute with $200,000 in cash strapped to his body. 2 hours later, the pilots landed the plane in Reno with the stairs still deployed. FBI agents, state troopers, and police surrounded the jet as no one knew for sure that the hijacker had jumped. Their search quickly confirmed that the mysterious man had vanished into the sky. I've been hearing this story since I was a little girl, and you know, you can see why it has stuck around so long. It's like something out of a spy movie. It's really kind of an amazing story. As you can imagine, a massive investigation ensued. Fingerprints were taken and confirmed to be those of the hijacker. Agents found Cooper's black clip-on tie, a tie clip, and two of the four parachutes, one of which had been opened and had the lines cut. Authorities interviewed everyone who had been in contact with the hijacker, and a composite sketch was produced. A suspect, an Oregon man with a criminal record named D.B. Cooper, was interviewed. A reporter erroneously tied this man's name to the hijacker, who had reported that his name was Dan Cooper, and the legend of D.B. Cooper was born from this mistake. Searchers then began to determine where they believed Cooper may have landed after he jumped. It was an enormous area and the task was overwhelming. Neither of the Air Force fighter pilots had seen anyone or anything exit the airliner visually or on radar, but visibility had been very poor. Investigators undertook a recreation of the event with the same pilot flying the plane and pushed a 200-pound sled out into the open air to kind of confirm that this is how the hijacker jumped. This helped them narrow down a possible landing zone, which initially placed Cooper's landing area near Mount St. Helens. FBI agents and sheriff's deputies searched massive areas of mountains and wilderness on foot and by helicopter. They went door to door to every farmhouse and even ran boat patrols along Lake Merwin and Yale Lake. No trace of D.B. Cooper, his equipment, or the money was found. For the next few years, the FBI would take out newspaper ads publishing the serial numbers of the bills, and they asked the public to check their bills periodically to determine if any of those bills had come back into circulation. None of the recorded bills were ever found to have been passed. It was later determined that D.B. Cooper's landing site would have probably been closer to Washougal Valley, and it was searched repeatedly. Then, on February 10, 1980, 8-year-old Brian Ingram was vacationing with his family on a section of beachfront property called Tina Bar on the Columbia River just downstream from Vancouver, Washington. He uncovered three packets of cash as he raked the sand to build a campfire. The bills were disintegrated but still bundled in rubber bands. The FBI confirmed that the bundles of found cash were in fact part of the ransom money given to the hijacker. This discovery raised almost more questions than it answered, but it was determined that the bills had washed ashore and had not been buried in the sand. The FBI allowed the boy who found the bills to keep some of them, and in 1986, he sold 15 of the bills for about $37,000. As of now, none of the remaining bills, 9,710 of them to be exact, have been recovered. No trace of the hijacker known as D.B. Cooper has been found. The FBI has obtained a partial DNA profile of the hijacker using samples found on his tie. Samples of some spots on the tie turned out to be rare earth minerals, which has led investigators to believe that D.B. Cooper may have been a metallurgist and may even have been a Boeing employee. Some believe Cooper had been a paratrooper in World War II, but most deny this, saying any experienced paratrooper would never have done what Cooper did. The FBI has people involved in this case who firmly believe the hijacker did not survive the jump. Due to the severe wind and rain at the time, many believe he never even got his parachute to open. Now, there are many, many suspects, so many that we would need an entire episode to review them. But as of now, the hijacker known as D.B. Cooper remains officially disappeared. Now, just like we always do on this channel, we discuss the element of food. On this playlist, Dining with the Disappeared, we discuss the food from the location where the person was last seen or where they disappeared from. Now, obviously, we're going to talk about airline food. Airline food fascinates me. As a chef, it's something that I wouldn't eat unless I kind of absolutely had to. First of all, it's not good. And also, just as someone who has spent a lot of time in the commercial food industry, food that's prepared one place and then packaged somewhere else and then taken somewhere else and then served somewhere else, it's not usually my practice to eat that. But airline food has not always been like it is now. Up to the 1960s, travelers were served things like Cornish game hen and pepper steak on full glassware dinner service sets. In the 1970s, the airline switched to plasticware. Can you imagine not only having to serve all of those people on the airplane, but then having to wash all of those dishes in those tiny quarters? Also in the 1970s, airlines went through a phase in which if you were flying first class, you had a 2-hour first class meal experience. If you weren't in first class, the entire cabin was served and finished with their meals in about 30 minutes. And this is kind of where things split and headed south for airline food. I absolutely love these vintage airline ads, and the ones featuring the meal service are my favorite. People used to get so dressed up when they flew. It was such a big deal. And my husband, who is the son of a retired airline pilot, still insists on looking nice when he flies. And yes, I'm someone who probably romanticizes the past a little bit, but I sure would like to see a return to this. I love these beautiful menus and photos of gorgeous people enjoying meals inside a spacious, well-kept airline cabin. I find the nostalgia and the clothes and the manners of times gone by very comforting. Flying used to be such a privilege and a special treat, and these photos definitely capture that time period well. One thing is for certain, the legend of D.B. Cooper and his disappearance has captured our imaginations for decades. And until a skeleton washes up from a river or is found in the mountains of Washington someday in the future, it will continue to do so. Thank you for joining me today on Dining with Death, Dining with the Disappeared. Like and subscribe if you would like to see more. Your subscriptions and your views help us so much. Stay safe and be kind to each other, and I'll see you next time on Dining with Death.
Americans are durable. We take pride in hard work and high quality. American Giant makes durable, quality clothing right here in the USA. Because what we wear reflects who we are. When you buy American Giant, you're not just wearing the best clothes money can buy. You're helping keep jobs and pride in your own backyard. Premium clothing built to last decades, like it should. Get 20% off your first order at American-Giant.com with code RIGHTHERE24.
Your Honor, I'd like to present to the ladies and gentlemen of the jury with Exhibit B, a bag of Sweet Tango apples.
Mmm, boy, these apples are delicious.
And zesty? Mmm, and sweet.
Best I ever tasted.
Your Honor, I object.
Overruled. Court dismissed. We need to recess to the grocery store for some Sweet Tango apples.
You love a great mystery, but not in the produce aisle. Be sure to reach for Sweet Tango, the most delicious tasting apple money can buy. Investigate where you can get yours at SweetTango.com.